Coming up is the news.
Iran says it's asked European countries to provide security for its diplomatic missions following violent protests outside some Iranian embassies. Israeli forces killed two Palestinians in the occupied West Bank following an alleged attempt to conduct a ramming attack against regime forces. And Yemen's six-month truce expires without being extended, the Yemeni army warning oil companies operating in the UAE and Saudi Arabia to leave. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The top story, Iran urging European countries to fulfill their international obligations and provide full security to its diplomatic missions. And that after violent protests hit several Iranian embassies in European capitals. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says that attacks were carried out by violent people affiliated with anti-Iran groups. Kanani was referring to a number of gatherings outside Iranian missions over the death of Mahsa Amini. The protests turned violent in London and Oslo, where several people were arrested by local police. Kanani says that the attackers managed to damage the outer sections of Iranian diplomatic missions as host countries failed to properly protect them. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, two Palestinians were shot dead by Israeli forces in connection with what the regime calls an attempted car ramming attack. The two were killed by Israeli fire near Ramallah, in the occupied West Bank. Earlier, media reports said that the Palestinians tried to ram a vehicle into Israeli special forces. The incident took place during a raid on a Palestinian refugee camp in the area. No Israeli casualties have been reported. The regime frequently storms Palestinian neighborhoods in the occupied West Bank. Forces fire at Palestinians who protest their presence. The United Nations has announced the end of a truce in Yemen reached between the Ansarullah movement and the Saud-led coalition that waged a war on the country in 2015. The world body says the negotiations are underway for a potential extension to the ceasefire, urging calm on the warring sides. Meantime, the spokesman for the Yemeni army blames Riyadh and his allies for failing to observe the UN-brokered truce that would have given Yemenis the right to exploit their oil reserves. General Yahya Saria warned oil companies operating in the UAE and Saudi Arabia to immediately leave the Yemeni territory. The Ansarullah movement had already blamed the Saud-led coalition's failure to live up to its commitments and reluctance to address humanitarian issues. The truce first came into effect on the 2nd of April for an initial 2 months and extended twice until October the 2nd. The UN mission of Afghanistan says death toll from a terrorist attack on education center in Kabul has risen to at least 43. Girls and young women were the main victims of the attack that targeted the Shia Hazara community. Afghans and clerics are calling for action to ensure the safety of the historically persecuted ethnic group. We have a report from the Afghan capital.
Afghanistan is still reeling from Friday's bomb attack in a Shia neighborhood in Kabul that left dozens of people dead and scores of others wounded. One of the victims of the attack was 18-year-old Najiba, whose family is grieving her loss. Najiba's father says he had raised his daughter with great difficulties, but lost her in the blink of an eye.
I've had a great passion in educating my children. I'm illiterate but love to see my children educated. However, I'm an ordinary worker, but I always supported them throughout their school with everything they needed. My daughter, Najiba, was so smart and intelligent. I was proud of her and loved her so much. I feel heartbroken that I'm not seeing her future and I've lost her forever.
Sakina Surosh, Najiba's sister and a social activist, says that systematic attacks on Shia mosques and schools must end. She calls on the UN to recognize such attacks as massacre.
My demand from the international bodies, especially the UN, is that the latest attack on Qadi Educational Center and other onslaughts on Shia community must be recognized as massacre and Hazara genocide. These attacks are systematically targeting innocent people from a specific ethnic group. The UN should not neglect in this regard and must take practical steps to protect persecuted Hazaras.
Beside international bodies and human rights groups, Afghanistan Shia Clerics Council has called for an investigation into such attacks. The Council called on the global community to end their silence on the murders of Shia Hazaras in Afghanistan.
Afghan clerics strongly condemn the attack on education and innocent students. We seriously call on the Taliban to take urgent and practical actions for ensuring security for all, especially Hazara people. The organizers and financiers of such crimes should be brought to justice. The international community must end their silence on the plight of Hazara people in Afghanistan.
Rights groups say the Daesh terrorist group has been responsible for 13 attacks against Hazaras since the Taliban's return to power. The attacks have killed or wounded at least 700 people from the community. The latest bomb attack has shocked people here. They are calling on the international community not to turn a blind eye on the plight of Shia Hazaras in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Brazilian electoral authorities say that the country's hotly contested presidential race is going to a runoff. The two frontrunners have failed to reach the threshold needed for the top executive job. Former leftist president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva garnered around 48% of the ballots against around 43% for incumbent president Jair Bolsonaro. That according to official results from the Superior Electoral Tribunal, the tallied votes cast at more than 97% of polling stations. Lula was short of more than 2% that he needed to hold the presidency. Some 156 million Brazilians were eligible to cast their ballots on Sunday. The runoff on October 30th will decide who will run the country next. Our correspondent Camila Escalante joined us a short while ago with details on the first round of the presidential elections in Brazil.
Despite the fact that Lula da Silva won in the first round, and this is a victory for him, he would have wanted to win outright with no need for a runoff election. However, that figure, 48%, it's almost 48.5%, represents more than 6 million votes between himself and Bolsonaro. So it's looking pretty good going into the next round. When you look at the map, you see that Lula and the PT did very well in a lot of the coastal, more populated regions and the regions in which there's a very strong presence of agribusiness. Bolsonaro fared very well. We did see some other very important wins by the Workers' Party and the left wing throughout the country on the level of Congress and state legislature, including by some really key Afro-descendant and Black leaders of the Workers' Party. So those were outright wins. There are some other races that will have to go to a second round. And Lula, of course, came out this evening when the vote count was sort of winding down, and he gave some statements. He said, you know, we're going to win in the next round. He celebrated the victory. He thanked his supporters and all of the candidates that ran for the Workers' Party and other parties that ran alongside the Workers' Party and lended their support and endorsed Lula's candidacy.
The EU warned Nicaragua of further international isolation after Managua expelled the Dutch ambassador. The EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, says the bloc, Rick Reitzen, rejects a decision which he called unjustified and unilateral. Borrell says the EU will respond in a firm and proportional manner. Nicaragua said Netherlands has repeatedly meddled in its affairs. It's accused Amsterdam of adopting a neo-colonialist stance. Nicaragua is also locked in a dispute with the U.S. and the EU for what it calls their meddling. It did not enter into the new U.S. ambassador and asked the EU ambassador to leave Nicaraguan soil last week. The British government has U-turned on the controversial plans to cut tax for the top earners amid an economic backlash. Finance Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng says that the cabinet will not proceed with the proposals as they became a distraction. The tax cut was part of a so-called mini-budget Prime Minister Liz Truss tabled early after taking office last month. The mini-budget triggered market turmoil and led to a record plunge in the value of the British pound. The UK is struggling to overcome rising inflation that has sparked industrial action across different sectors. The latest was the weekend action by more than 50,000 railway workers. That was the largest one-day rail strike in decades. The Nord Stream 2 pipeline is no longer leaking natural gas, but questions remain over the act of sabotage and who was behind it. That was a deliberate attempt at shutting off gas to Europe. But who's guilty? Russia, who has been accused of using energy as a weapon? Or the U.S., whose president once said if Russia carries through with a special military operation, the Nord Stream pipeline would not be operational?
When it comes to the Nord Stream pipeline sabotage, a fourth leak has been found. That was enough for a Security Council meeting to take place. But at the end of the session, Russia was blamed for the act of sabotage. Russia and the West are trading blame over this. Although Russia has not accused the US by name, all of its statements are pointing the finger at the US. The same goes for the US and the EU. Both have stopped short of directly accusing Russia. Russia has said that the US president is obliged to answer the question of whether the US carried out its threat.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
But how will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
Meanwhile, Washington also dismissed the suggestion and accused Russia of spreading disinformation. While the EU has said the sabotage was deliberate, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it would be in no one's interest if the leaks were caused deliberately. But Blinken's point that it would be in no one's interest can be argued otherwise. In the case of the U.S., it would reap huge benefits. For example, it would continue selling gas to the EU and make huge profits. Some single shipments are bringing in $200 million for the U.S. The U.S. is now sending 60% of its liquefied natural gas exports to Europe, up from less than 20% this time a year ago. Meanwhile, the high gas and electricity prices are pushing European manufacturers to shift to the U.S. This is because there are relatively stable prices in there, with green energy incentives also luring the companies to the U.S. The U.S. has recently adopted Inflation Reduction Act, makes it a particularly attractive destination for companies in the chemicals, batteries, and green energy sectors. It aims to increase manufacturing and level the international playing field by using American incentives to match the competition from overseas. But what about the other parties that are related to Russia's Nord Stream pipeline, namely Russia and the EU? Would either benefit from the act of sabotage on the pipeline? The answer is a resounding no in the case of the EU. In Europe, more and more companies are switching into survival mode. For a lot of them, the time is coming to renew their electricity supply contracts with utilities. And thanks to the energy inflation, these are set to be much higher than the contracts for the current year. Meanwhile, the European Commission has promised to help by capping the revenues of oil, gas, and coal companies. As for Russia, it would lose income, so that would also be ruled out. Russia has said that Europe is now indefinitely deprived of key gas supply routes. It said that it is searching for ways to get the pipelines up and running, but the timeline cannot yet be estimated. So the big winner from the energy crisis in Europe would be the US.
The Nord Stream sabotage has triggered a new crisis between the West and Russia. But in this scenario, the U.S. has the most to gain out of the crisis. Trying to demonize Russia, it's reaping the benefits of gas sales while European companies consider or are actively relocating to the U.S. And more importantly, once European factories and firms go through this relocation, the U.S. can be assured that Europe is on its side in its confrontation with China.
Europe's descent into deindustrialization is happening at warp speed. With the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline, there is no way back. Europe can no longer import Russian gas, and this means that prices will remain high until Europe builds more energy capacity, and this could take years. High energy prices will, in essence, make European manufacturing uncompetitive. After all, European manufacturers will be forced to pass the higher energy cost to the end user or the consumers. And that is how many European businesses will begin to unravel. According to one analyst, the only logical European response to the threat of widespread deindustrialization is to raise tariffs. This is the only way to balance out prices between more expensive European goods and cheaper foreign goods. One of the consequences, however, is that it will lower living standards, depriving Europeans of cheaper priced goods. The question is whether the Biden administration knowingly nudged Europe to decouple from Russian energy sources in order to lure European companies toward the influence sphere of Washington.
Moving on, the Pentagon chief says the United States is prepared to protect its interests in the Indo-Pacific and to help Taiwan against China. Lloyd Austin accused Beijing of trying to start what it called a new normal with Taiwan, with increased military activity near the island. He said Washington is committed to helping Taiwan develop its defense capabilities. China considers Taiwan part of its territory. It's repeatedly warned the U.S. against ties with the island and intervention in the region. China says it's ready to take military action to protect its sovereignty. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Hi, how are you? Fine, thanks. I just got your medicines from a nearby pharmacy. Oh, don't mention it. Love you, bye. Well, it was my grandma. She was checking if I had bought her medicines. What was interesting for me is that most of these medicines have herbal basics. It's great that God has created so many valuable herbs. By the way, tomorrow I'm going to visit Rhubarb Plain of Shahr Babak in Kerman province. In this eye-catching plain, rhubarb plant is grown. This wonderful plant has lots of medicinal advantages. Stay with me. Shahr Babak is an important city in Kerman, which is located west of this province. In the 20-kilometer distance of Shahr Babak, there is a plain with a beautiful and eye-catching view which is known as Rhubarb Plain. This plain is considered as one of the touristic districts of Shahr Babak, which shines like a red gem and shows a very beautiful scene of nature. From middle of April, for 2 to 3 weeks, the 2,400-hectare plain is all red with a vast coverage of the plant rhubarb. The leaves of this plant are large and green, while its bunch-like flower is red, which creates a spectacular view. Rhubarb has some elements in itself, such as potassium and calcium, and it is relatively rich in vitamins. The petiole of rhubarb, which is its usable part, has some organic acids, such as malic acid, which is beneficial for quenching thirst and easing the digestion of food. If I'm going the right direction. Sorry, sir. How can I get to Rubar Plain of Shahr Babak?
Go straight. You have just 1 kilometer to the plain.
Thank you very much indeed. I've heard that rhubarb is rich in antioxidants, particularly anthocyanins, which give it its red color. These antioxidants have antibacterial, anti-inflammatory, and anti-cancer properties, which help protect you from many health-related issues such as heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. Wonderful. I see a vast red velvet blanket just in front of my eyes. Beautiful, gorgeous, extraordinary. Have you ever tasted this advantageous plant? I have not. Let me try some. Sour and very delicious. And of course, rich in calcium and potassium. I'll get some for my grandma and myself. Rhubarb is a very beneficial plant that is also used in making fruits or desserts. You can also see this plant in the villages and cities around Shahr Babak. Until next time, goodbye!
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It appears that the Yemen truce is at a dead end. Not only have the Ansarullah movement made that announcement, the fragile truce, which was broken by the Saudi-led coalition many times, has now ended without it being renewed, despite attempts by UN envoy Hans Grotenberg to extend it. Why would this ceasefire end? Why is there a lack of political will to end this conflict? Is it because the Saudis have not budged, especially when it comes to their chokehold of the port city of Hodeidah? Just a couple of the questions that we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our correspondent from Sana'a, Yusuf Mari, in order to get the latest coming on this. Yusuf Mari, the way that this truce was announced for it to have ended came from the Ansarullah on the one hand, where they said that it has reached a dead end. But then when you read the news, one particular piece of news that said the U.S. State Department has said that Anthony Blinken welcomed Saudi Arabia's commitment to extending the Yemen truce just yesterday. It kind of sends a conflicting report on this in terms of whether it has ended or not.
That's a good point you bring up. In point blank, Saudi Arabia has welcomed the extension of the ceasefire agreement. However, the Sana'a government is rejecting the current structure of the extension of the ceasefire agreement. Look, you know, since the ceasefire was announced 6 months ago, Ansarullah, the Sana'a government, has been very clear. This is just a ceasefire to see if political negotiations can take place to reach the ultimate end, the ultimate goal, which is to completely lift the strangling blockade on Yemen, to open Sana'a International Airport, and to ensure that government salaries are paid to all government employees. And Ansarullah presented it as a precondition that by the time the ceasefire ends, if these main demands are not met, they will not commit to any extension of any ceasefire agreement that employs the strangling blockade, that continues the blockade on Yemen, that continues the blockage of roads, that refuses to pay Yemeni government salaries, their monthly salaries. And under the current structure of the ceasefire agreement, Sana'a International Airport remains very limited, which means that, you know, you can only fly in and out of Sana'a Airport from Sana'a to Amman, Amman to Sana'a, and from Egypt to Sana'a and Sana'a to Egypt. These are the only two countries where Yemeni flights are allowed to depart from and to land. So this is not according to what the Ansarullah movement see as a just extension of a ceasefire agreement or any peace deal for that matter. And the Ansarullah movement's leadership, they've been very clear that by the time, by October 2nd, if the ceasefire agreement does not meet the demands of the Yemeni people, they will take military preparations. They will not hesitate to use their ballistic missile capability, which they have displayed over the past month or so, which featured a number of advanced military equipment such as armored vehicles, ballistic missiles, which we have not seen before, which have not been presented, and which the Saudi coalition did not expect the Yemeni armed forces to be in their disposal. So, 3 hours after the ceasefire agreement ended, with at 6 p.m. Yemen Sana'a time, there hasn't been any aerial bombardments in the capital Sana'a, or for that matter, there hasn't been any aerial attacks from the Ansarullah movement into Saudi territory. However, what I can tell you is that there has been a couple of reports of sporadic fighting taking place on a couple of battlefronts, which is an indication that the fighting on the ground has somewhat resumed in some parts of the country.
Thank you very much for that, Yusuf Mari. Appreciate it. A correspondent there from Sana'a. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Firas Al-Najim, human rights activist, joins us from Ottawa. Also joining us is Said Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Said Mohsen Abbas, let me first start with you. We just asked a correspondent about the different perspectives that is being looked at when it comes to this truce. And the point that's being made here is that as far as the Ansarullah is concerned, it's reached a dead end and that the ceasefire has actually expired. But yet you have the U.S. That has said it welcomes the extension of the truce by Saudi Arabia. So they think that that the status quo during the ceasefire, which led to nothing, is okay for it to continue, at least based on what our correspondent there said. But there's a point to be made here. Why hasn't there been a political will by the Saudis in particular, or the Saudi coalition, to reach some kind of solution, compromise, or what have you?
It's a completely perplexing situation. The Saudi Arabians really don't benefit from this war in any substantial way. They're not huge international geopolitical players, so they don't really gain from trying to get hold of the Bab al-Mandeb Straits, which has a huge international shipping, influence and a vital strategic, role there. They don't benefit even from the Socotra Island, you know, which is, again, another part of that waterway going past Yemen, which ultimately doesn't really benefit the Saudis. The Saudis have oil of their own. They haven't got a shortage of oil. So the little bit of oil that Yemen did have, in Hadramaut, for instance, doesn't really equate to something that's going to change the Saudi economic situation in a huge way. The Yemenis weren't threatening Saudi sovereignty in any way. They simply had an internal, of course, dispute going on about who should rule the country. And it was the Saudis who were obviously, along with the Americans, controlling puppet governments. And that puppet government wasn't delivering anything which was really beneficial for Yemen in the long run. And that's where the trouble really began. So, first of all, in answer to the question of the Saudis' benefit, they have no benefit. So who does benefit? Well, it's certainly the Americans and the Western powers who have far bigger interests in controlling the Bab al-Mandeb Straits. It's they who have an interest in locking down that southern tip of Arabia for whatever military, geostrategic, future maritime, economic reasons they have. So in a sense, the Saudis are a proxy for a war which really only benefits the Zio Western Empire. Now, to add to the woes of the Yemeni people, even when Ansarullah do go into these truce arrangements with Saudi Arabia, it's happened time and time again, what ends up happening is that Saudis continue their air bombardments. They continue with air raids that essentially knock out hospitals. They target schools. They target marketplaces. They target waterworks, resulting in cholera and famine and all sorts. And worse still, now they're also preventing things like even mine clearance, which I'll come on to perhaps in the next part of my
sure, my, sure. We'll get to that, definitely. I need to ask you, Feroz Al-Najim, if we do a check on as to why the ceasefire came into place in the first place. If memory serves me right, you had the Ansarullah achieve successes on the battlefield many times over, and one of the major the destructions placed upon the Saudis were the attacks with the ballistic missiles by the army onto the Saudi Aramco oil facility. So the Saudis were forced at that point to basically bend and agree to a ceasefire. Why would they then not proceed during the ceasefire that has been renewed so many times now to move towards some kind of political solution, so that they don't come again under the offensive by the Ansarullah movement?
Yes, I mean, they didn't do this. They didn't, start the ceasefire or sign it, out of goodwill. Like you said, it was because Ansarullah, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi and his army, the Yemeni army, obviously, we're striking hard inside Saudi Arabia and hitting very important areas, that have to do with their economy. And, there was a big threat to them. Also they did a lot of attacks in Riyadh as well. So this they were extending and expanding their attacks against the Saudi regime. And it was dangerous for them at that time. So they wanted to kind of calm things down. And the ceasefire is not really helping in many ways. It's just, you know, there's not much bombardments, let's just say, and war, actual battles on the ground. But at the same time, you know, this embargo is, and this they're trying to choke the Yemeni nation, and many things cannot get inside the nation that are like they need them, especially in hospitals, medical supplies, many things that are not available for the Yemeni people. And now with the inflations that are hitting the whole world because of the war with Ukraine and so on. So, you know, they delay these processes to actually come down to a real resolution. And the reason why is because Saudi Arabia doesn't have sovereignty, and they don't have control of what really to do and how to change things. The thing is, the U.S. is behind this, and the U.S. will not compromise and sacrifice Bab al-Mandab when they know that Hormuz, you know, is in the hands of the Iranians, and any time they can choke that area, that apart and close it down and stop any shipments and any kind of way for any Americans or any of their puppet regimes to move anything in that area. So if Bab al-Mandab is also choked, that means the whole Middle East is in the control of the axis of resistance. And this is what's their real fear. This is why they will not stop this war. Because stopping this war means Ansarullah becomes legitimate, becomes credible, becomes open to opening relations with other countries, and they can start to import weapons, they can start to import security materials, they can strengthen their control of that area, and they know that Ansarullah, their focus and their main goal, as they always speak about, is that they want to liberate Palestine and they want to secure and save the Palestinian people.
Well, this is what's confusing. I mean, you have 6 months of these, if negotiations were taking place, I'm sure they were in one form or another. But the Ansarullah has come out accusing the Saudi-led coalition, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, of stalling, saying that, you know, you guys didn't even help alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni people. You're still chokeholding and laying a siege on the port city of Hodeidah. You're not letting humanitarian goods, at a minimum, be able to cross on and trickle down into the land and reach the people. So is this announcement by the Houthis, I'm sorry, by the Ansarullah movement, that it has reached a dead end, this reason,
because they
haven't reached any kind of compromise on that?
I think the Saudis are playing games. As their masters in the background, the Israelis and the Americans, don't want any kind of real cessation of war. There's no solution to this this dispute, this situation, through military means for neither a party. At the end of the day, only a diplomatic and political solution can be a real, you know, game changer and something which would conclude this war. But it's quite clear that it's not in the interests of the Zio-Western Empire to stop this war. And let me give you some examples of why. Number one, they're making money out of this. Look, for instance, let me just put the State Department's approval of about $30.1 billion of arms contracts for Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, Lockheed. I could roll off the list of, you know, military, you know, industrial arms complex fraternity that have gained huge amounts of money from this. What's more, they also get to test these weapons on poor people in Yemen. You know, all the testing of this kind of firepower, which needs to be done, also is part of the game. And the result is that then it becomes a race amongst all of these kind of very, very inhumane Western so-called secular democracies. Because please note that just this week, Germany has begun to also supply weapons, even though in 2018 it put a ban saying that it was against their policy to supply conflict zones with arms. Well, they've just done a deal with the Saudis, the UAE, etc., and they too are now up for supplying. I think Germany has approved a new range of arms exports.
Right, it did. Why did it do that?
Make it worse.
Why did it do that? Is that a signal of something coming up in terms of perhaps Saudi Arabia wanting to come throw itself back into the heat of the war again? Is that why Germany perhaps renewed? I mean, Germany came out and said in December, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, the new government coalition, that government came into place. They said, we're not going to sell any arms to Saudi Arabia. That wasn't that long ago. So what happened?
Well, what you can appreciate is that since then, Ukraine and the war in Europe has kicked off. Now, what's happened is the Germans, the first violation of that rule that they made was in supplying weapons to Ukraine. So that's opened the floodgates. And of course, this is what the Americans have maneuvered the Germans and the European nations into, the militarization. So Germany is compelled to do this. Actually, it's with a joint program with Italy, Britain and France. They're not doing it on their own. This is the increase of this arms supply to Saudi, which will perpetuate the war in Yemen, is coming from all of these European nations. Sure. And America is the one behind it.
First on Najim, back in September of 2022, not that long ago, about a month and a half, I don't know if you watched this huge military parade and display by the Yemeni army. I mean, it was quite spectacular. And what it did, it caught many by surprise because of the depth and the volume, not only in terms of the personnel, but also the awesome military equipment that was on display, from tanks to drones to what have you. So we're seeing that. And at the same time, we're looking at how Saudi Arabia perhaps is viewing that, along with this coalition, whatever's left of it. So it signaled that they had entered another military playing field by that display, the Yemeni army, that is, which means that this war, if they were to continue, it would be a different type of war for them. Do the Saudis realize that? Did they interpret that awesome display of power the way that the Yemeni army did?
I mean, the Saudis in history have, you know, they were stuck and trapped inside Yemen, and they lost. And many people have lost in history because Yemen is known to be the graveyard of the invaders. You know, in Arabic, they call it Maqbarat al-Ghuzat. So the Yemenis are known to be, you know, warriors, that they defend their country, they care about their sovereignty. They won't be submissive to any colonial powers that try to take control. And this is just one show in this era right now, showing how with this huge blockade, with all this bombardment, this huge coalition, and many mercenaries that were bought, you know, there was, you know, many organizations or companies that were involved in this. There was many governments that were bought out, such as Sudan, former government of Sudan, you know, Omar Bashir, when he was in power. They went out and bought out people. They just, you know, whatever country was suffering, they told them, okay, bring your army and we'll pay you money. We'll help you with your financial issues and then get inside Yemen. And they all lost inside Yemen. And the Yemenis were able to, you know, capture all these different soldiers from different countries and humiliate them on TV and show, you know, that we caught the Sudani soldiers, we caught these kind of soldiers. And it was a major loss and humiliation for all the world. You know, this logistical support is being given by the UK, France, and USA. These are the three main powers that, you know, expanded their colonial and control of a lot of the world. And they cannot deal with this poor nation of, you know, determined people. So it shows that the Yemenis are now in a very high stage and high level. They're very advanced. Their weapons are actually advancing. And I think the axis of resistance is helping them somehow. You know, it's either just by giving them support, giving them information, you know, it's consultation, things like that. But the rest is all Yemeni hands, Yemeni brains, Yemeni determination. And the Yemenis have proven to the world that nobody can break their will, nobody can break their unity, nobody can break their government. You know, it's an amazing nation, honestly, compared. And it's a very good, amazing example to the world that you cannot break people's determination if they're united and they're oppressed.
Simonson Abbas, so trying to figure out here what game plan the Saudis have and the coalition. I mean, after the question that I asked about the display of the military might of the Yemeni army, you really can't compare it to what they were, even though from what they were with what they had at hand previously, they were able to, in a sense, bring about that truce because they almost defeated the Saudi-led coalition in so many ways. So what could be in the Saudis' mind at this point if indeed this has ended, this truce, or are they going to try to claw their way back into a truce with the Ansarullah movement?
Well, it could be that the deep state, the Israeli and the American deep state, have convinced the Saudis that, look, if you go for it, we're going to perhaps supply you with even more, as Donald Trump put it, shiny weapons to actually milk the Saudis. That's what the Americans are doing, even under Biden. Maybe they managed to persuade the very unwise Saudi leadership. I mean, look, the reality is that Saudi has been given the olive branch several times, even by the Islamic Republic of Iran and the resistance axis. And they have sensibly said, look, even the Hope initiative was designed to say, look, let's solve our regional problems ourselves. Let's not resort to bringing in America, bringing in, you know, the Western powers, because that only exacerbates the problem. The Saudis, unfortunately, for many, many decades, if not from their inception, have been part of an Anglo-Zionist imperialist, guarantee in that region to continue the trouble, to continue division, to continue sectarian and religious hatred, and to supply the likes of ISIS, Al-Qaeda. Will Saudi change that attitude? Do they have the power to do it? No, I don't think so. You saw that as soon as bin Salman came in, he immediately stamped his foot down, and even the top layer of the Saudi monarchy, if you like, and the family of al-Saud were virtually incarcerated. They were locked up in huge, expensive hotels until they coughed up with the money that they needed to sign off whatever bin Salman wanted or Mohammed bin Salman wanted. Now, the bottom line is that dictatorship, that okay. despotism, is what America's propping up, and whether sure. they can switch it whichever way they want, whenever they want.
Thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Saeed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London, and from Ottawa, Firas Al-Najim, human rights activist. Thank you very much. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikobe Tahwe, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, we have very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Nur Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Okay, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, for today's discussion, we want to get into a very important topic, and it is the possibility of we human beings being a part of the, we can say, spirit of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, is it at all possible that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blown into us, into a physic, from his own soul and spirit? Or we are, in better words, we are from the spirit of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it at all true or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. For those people who are familiar with the verse of Noble Quran, we have one verse or maybe other verses talking about the blowing the spirit of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to the body of human being. وَنَفَخْتُ فِيهِمْ مِنْ رُوحِ. In the beginning of creation of mankind, actually you may call it the Genesis, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blew his spirit into the mankind. What does it mean? We are talking about this issue. Maybe for some of the listeners, sounds to be to some extent complicated. And the reason of that is because most of the people, they're only familiar with the material aspect of human being, with the body, with what we like, what we desire, what we hate. And most of our, concern, they are about the these material tendencies. And most of us, if not all, we are not familiar with other realm of creation. We are not about other dimension and aspect of human being. But for the wonder of our listeners, we have two dimensions of human being. First of all, we have physical aspect that all of us, we are familiar. And we have this physical aspect of human being. On the other hand, we have a spiritual aspect of human being, you may call it the reality of human being or the soul. According to some verse of Noble Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that min ruhi, which is the spirit of Allah. In other words, we have nafs, qalb, aql, and other maybe term, Quranic terms with regards to the entity and the reality of human being. I need to emphasize this point that my dear listener get this point that when we say that the reality of human being and the entity of human being, we mean that human being, as I said, has one reality behind this physical existence. And the reality of human being, and this is what is a human being himself? Okay.
Yes.
What is the reality of human being? The existence of human being is actually the soul that we call it ruh or other terms, Quranic terms that I share with my dear listeners. Most of the people are not familiar with that, but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that. When I want to create human being, actually, I'm talking about the beginning of the creation of mankind. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, had this kind of creation of human being and blow from his spirit to the mankind. But min ruhi idafa tashrifiyya, which means Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala attribute the spirit to himself. Like, for example, Baytullah, the host of Allah. It does not mean that Allah has hosts, or, for example, the spirit is, from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
Rather, it means because of the importance of that and the magnitude of that, he ascribed it to himself.
Yes.
And he wanted to say that I have created this one, and it has been connected to me. And because of that, wanted to give some kind of priority and importance to that. So, these are very brief explanation of the creation of mankind. And inshallah, I will talk more about the what is a reality of ruh and what kind of traits and characteristics it has. But I need to confess that we do not have much information about that. We need to have some kind of comprehensive analysis of the idea of ruh.
That's all right.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Inshallah, inshallah, inshallah.
For sure, this is the main, we can say, difference, we can say, between human beings and the other animals. Because we know that the animals have a spirit too, isn't it? They are born with a spirit.
Yes.
But the case is that the case of the spirit put in the human being